On Trial by Anton Chekhov. In the district capital N stands a brown government building, used in turn by the Zemso executive, the session of justices, the peasant, licensing, recruiting, and many other local authorities. And here, on a dull autumn day, were held the district assizes. This was the brown building of which a local official joked, "It's the seat of justice, of the police, of the militia. In fact, quite an institute for young gentlewomen." In confirmation of the proverb that too many cooks spoil the broth, this brown building makes a bad impression on the unofficial man by its gloomy, barrack-like view, its air of decay, and by the entire absence of even a pretense of comfort, without or within. Even on glaring spring days, it is oppressed by deep shadows. And on bright, moonlight nights, when trees and houses, blending in one thick shade, repose in deep gloom, it squats alone like a dumpy stone, crushing and out of place on the modest landscape, spoils the harmony of its neighbors, and breathes an irritable restlessness, as if tortured by memories of past unforgiven sins. Inside, it's a barn, painfully comfortless. It's strange indeed how these fastidious procurators, judges, marshals of the nobility, who at home make scenes over a smoking chimney or a stain on the floor, are reconciled here with the humming ventilators, the sickening smell of wax matches, and the dirty, damp-spotted walls. When at 9 o'clock the court assembled, trials began with unusual haste. Case after case ended quickly, as a church service without hymns, and no one reaped a single picturesque impression from the hurried, heterogeneous procession of men, movements, speeches, misfortunes, truths, falsehoods. By 2 o'clock much work had been done. Two men, condemned to punitive regiments, one criminal of the privileged classes, deprived of his rights and sent to jail, one prisoner acquitted, and one case postponed. At 2 o'clock, the president announced the trial of Nikolai Karlamov on the charge of murdering his wife. The court was constituted as during the earlier cases. The counsel for the accused was a new barrister, a young, beardless candidate in a frock coat with bright buttons. "Bring in the accused," cried the president. But the accused was already on his way to the dock. He was a tall, sturdy peasant, aged 55, bald, with an apathetic, hairy face, and a great carroty beard. Behind him marched a little insignificant soldier armed with a rifle. Almost at the door of the dock, an accident happened to this soldier. He slipped suddenly, and his rifle flew from his hand. Before it touched the floor, he caught it, but knocked his knee sharply against the butt. Whether from pain or from confusion at his awkwardness, the soldier turned very red. There was the usual questioning of the accused, assembling of jurymen, counting and swearing of witnesses. The indictment was read. A narrow-shouldered, pale secretary, much too thin for his uniform, with sticking plaster on his cheek, read quickly in a low, thick bass, which, as if fearing to injure his chest, he neither raised nor lowered. As accompaniment, the ventilators hummed tirelessly behind the judge's bench, and the general result was a chorus which broke on the silence of the room with drowsy, narcotic effect. The presiding judge, a short-sighted, middle-aged man with a look of extreme fatigue, sat motionless and held his hand to his forehead as if shading his eyes from the sun. While the ventilator hummed and the secretary droned, he was thinking of something not connected with work. When the secretary paused to take a breath and turn over a page, he started suddenly, and bending to the ear of his colleague, asked with a sigh, "Are you staying at Demyanov's, Matvei Petrovich?" "Yes, Demyanov's," was the reply, also given with a start. "Next time I'll stay there, too. Tipiakov's is absolutely unendurable. Noise and uproar all night. Tapping, coughing, crying children. It's unbearable. The assistant procurator, a stout, sated brunette, with gold spectacles and a neatly trimmed beard, sat motionless as a statue, and resting his face on his hand, his eyes expressed greedy absorption, and his brows rose higher and higher. Sometimes he lay back in his chair and looked indifferently ahead, but soon again became absorbed in his book. The defending advocate drew a blunt pencil along the table and, his head inclined aside, thought. His young face expressed only concentrated, cold tedium, such tedium as shows on the faces of schoolboys and clerks who sit day after day in the same places and see the same people and the same walls. The speech he was to make in no way troubled him. And indeed, what was it? By command of his senior, it would follow a long-established convention, and conscious that it was colorless and tiresome, without passion or fire, he would blurt it out to the jurymen, then gallop away through rain and mud to the railway station, thence to town, where he would be sent somewhere else in the district to make another stupid speech. It was tiresome. At first, the prisoner coughed nervously and paled. But soon, even he succumbed to the all-pervading calm, monotony, and tedium. Glancing with dull respect at the judge's uniforms and the jurymen's tired faces, he blinked his eyes indifferently. The legal atmosphere and procedure, fear of which had so tormented him in jail, acted now as a sedative. Nothing fulfilled his expectations. He had come into court charged of murder. Yet he found no threatening faces, no indignant gestures, no loud phrases about justice, no interest in his uncommon lot. Not even his judges turned on him a long and searching glance. The dark windows, the walls, the secretary's voice, the procurator's pose, all were soaked with official indifference and exhaled a chill. It seemed as if a murderer were a simple office accessory, as if he were to be judged not by living men, but by some invisible machine brought God knows whence. The narcotized peasant did not understand that his judges were as used to the dramas and tragedies of life as hospital doctors are to death, and that it was just in this mechanical impartiality that lay the terror, the hopelessness of his case. For if, instead of sitting still, he had risen and begun to implore, to shed tears for mercy, to repent bitterly, to die of despair, all would have fallen as vainly upon numbed nerves and custom as waves upon a rock. The indictment was finished. The president aimlessly stroked the table before him, blinked his eyes at the prisoner, and asked, idly rolling his tongue, "Prisoner at the bar, do you confess to the murder of your wife on the evening of the 9th of July?" "I'm not guilty," answered the accused man, rising and holding the breast of his callet. The court hurriedly set about the examination of witnesses, and soon had questioned two peasant women, five men, and the detective charged with the investigation of the crime. All of these, splashed with mud, fatigued with walking and waiting in the witnesses' room, melancholy and morose, told the same tale. Karlamov, they agreed, lived with his wife well, and beat her only when he was drunk. At sunset on the 9th of July, the old woman was found in the shed attached to her cabin, with her skull beaten in. Beside her in a pool of blood lay a hatchet. When they looked for Karlamov, to tell him of the tragedy, he was neither in the hut nor in the street. They looked for him about the village, searched the drink shops and huts, but he had vanished. 2 days later, he appeared at the office, pale, tattered, trembling all over. He was handcuffed and locked up. "Prisoner," the president turned to Karlamov, "can you not explain to the court where you spent the 2 days after the murder?" "I tramped the country. I had nothing to eat or drink. But if you were innocent, why did you hide yourself?" "I was afraid. I thought I might be accused.
I see. Very good. Sit down.
The district physician who examined the woman's body was the last witness. He told the court all that he remembered out of the post-mortem protocol, and added what he had reasoned out on the way to the trial. The president blinked at the witness's new shiny black coat, his fashionable necktie, his moving lips. And through his head ran the idle thought. Everyone wears short coats nowadays. Why's his cut long? Why long and not short? Behind the president, boots creaked cautiously. The assistant procurator had come to the table to fetch a paper.
Mikhail Vladimirovich.
The assistant procurator bent down to the president's ear. This Karaisky has investigated the case with incredible carelessness. The man's brother was not even questioned, and you can't make head or tail of the description of the hut.
What can you do? What can you do? Sighed the president, leaning back in his chair.
By the by, resumed the assistant procurator, look here in the hall, the first bench, the man with the actor's face. That's the local money magnat. He has about 500,000 in ready cash.
Indeed. He doesn't look it.
Well, old man, shall we have an interval?
Let's finish the case, and then...
How do you know? The president turned to the doctor. So you find that death was immediate?
Yes, as the result of serious injury to the substance of the brain.
When the doctor finished, the president looked at the blank space between procurator and defending counsel and asked,
Have you any questions to put?
The assistant procurator, without lifting his eyes from Kane, shook his head. The defending counsel moved brusquely, coughed, and asked,
Tell me, doctor, judging by the size of the wound, could you form any judgment as to
the murderer's mental condition? That is, I want to know if the size of the wound justifies our concluding that the accused was in an epileptic fit. The president turned his sleepy, indifferent glance on the defending counsel. The procurator raised his eyes from Kane and looked at the president. But it was a mere look, expressing neither amusement nor surprise, expressing, in fact, nothing at all. The doctor hesitated. If you consider the force with which the accused delivered the blow, otherwise, but excuse me, I don't quite understand your point.
The defending lawyer got no answer to his question, and indeed needed none. He knew that it had arisen in his mind and flowed from his lips merely under the spell of the tedium, the stillness, the humming ventilators. Releasing the doctor, the court examined the articles produced as evidence. First, they looked at a caftan, on the sleeve of which was a dark brown spot of blood. The origin of this spot was explained by Karlamov as follows. 3 days before my wife's death, Penkov bled his horse. I was there and, of course, helped him, and I got smeared with blood.
But Penkov has just sworn that he does not remember you being present when the horse was bled.
Well, I don't know. Sit down.
The court examined the hatchet found beside the dead woman.
That's not my hatchet, said the accused.
Whose then?
I don't know. I had no hatchet.
No peasant can carry on his business without a hatchet. Your neighbor, Ivan Timofeich, who mended the sledge with you, swears that the hatchet's yours.
I know nothing. Only this, that I swear before God...
Karlamov extended his hand and opened wide his fingers.
I swear before my true creator, I cannot even remember when I last had a hatchet. I once had one like that, only a little smaller, but my son, Proshka, lost it. About 2 years before he was taken as a soldier, he went to cut wood. He went playing with the children and lost it.
That'll do. Sit down. The persistent distrust and unwillingness of all to listen at last irritated and enraged Karlamov. He blinked his eyes furiously, and on his cheekbones appeared 2 bright red spots.
"Before the eyes of God," he exclaimed, stretching out his hand, "if you do not believe me, then ask my son Proshka. He spoke in a rough voice and turned suddenly to the little soldier who guarded him. "Proshka, where's the hatchet? Where is the hatchet?" It was a terrible moment. All in court, it seemed, sank into their seats and dwindled to points. Through every head, like lightning, flashed one and the same terrible thought, and not one out of all of them dared to look at the soldier's face. Each did his best to discredit his own ears, to cherish the delusion that he had not heard right. "Prisoner, you are not allowed to speak to the guard," said the president hastily. No one saw the soldier's face, and terror flew through the court unseen. The usher rose from his bench and, on tiptoes, swinging his arms, went out of the hall. In half a minute came the sound of dull footfalls and such noises as are heard when sentries are relieved. All raised their heads, and trying to look as if nothing uncommon had happened, continued their work.